Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's talk about trade, because just about everyone is, at least on the presidential campaign. Here's Bernie Sanders, for example, just yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press, going after Hillary Clinton's past support of U.S. trade agreements.
When you vote for virtually every trade agreement that has cost workers of this country millions of jobs, the American people do not believe that that is the kind of president that we need to protect the working families of this country.
And here's Donald Trump, also yesterday at a rally in Rochester, New York.
Rochester lost 90,000 jobs since 1970, 4,000 jobs in the last 6 months. So we're going to make the greatest trade deals ever made by any country. I'm good at that stuff. That's what I do.
Hyperventilation and hyperbole. That's what some increasingly nervous analysts are saying when they hear the amped-up rhetoric on trade. Just listen to Steve Odland, CEO of the Committee for Economic Development, a nonpartisan public policy organization. Here he is on NBC.
We need adults here to come back and say, look, everybody take a breath, because there are some real benefits here to trade. And with the wrong actions, we could break the very economy that we have put in place here over the years.
But of course, it is that very same economy that's left so many American workers behind. So what's the best way to think about the complexities of international trade agreements in a season that favors simplified political claims? To help us think about that question, we're joined now by David Otter. He's professor of economics at MIT. Professor Otter, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much, Meghna. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. First of all, can I just get your sense of whether or not you were surprised that free trade is playing such a prominent role in this presidential election season so far?
Yes, I am surprised, but I don't think it's completely off point. In fact, the last 35 years have been not good for blue-collar Americans, and wages and employment have fallen. And that's mostly not due to trade, in fact. But the last 20 years, and particularly the period of the 2000s, U.S. manufacturing was really deeply affected by rising international competition, particularly from China. And that did displace a lot of workers. That doesn't mean that trade wasn't in net beneficial, but the benefits are quite diffuse. They lower prices for many people, but the costs are quite concentrated on the individuals who lose employment. And work that I've done with my colleagues Gordon Hansen and David Dorn, as well as others, shows that those workers, you know, do experience pretty significant long-term effects. They don't
right.
bounce right back into new jobs at the same wages. Far from it.
Well, I mean, isn't this the fundamental, the heart of the issue here? Is that economists frequently talk about, or you know, and the media talks about trade and trade deals in terms of increased GDP following the signing of these deals. But I mean, that's a broad-based metric that doesn't take into account or doesn't talk enough about how what you just said is that the cost of the trade deals is very concentrated amongst certain American workers who haven't recovered following the losses of their jobs when their jobs are moved overseas.
That's correct. So, I mean, the simplest way to say it is that trade increases the size of the pie, but it can actually shrink some slices in absolute terms as it does that. And there's nothing inconsistent about saying, you know, trade with China makes the U.S. pie 3 or 4% larger, but makes certain slices 30 or 40% smaller. And I think it's we should not conflate these two issues. We should not say that the fact that that not everyone wins doesn't mean trade is necessarily a bad thing. It means, in fact, there's enough, the pie is large enough that we could actually make everyone's slice slightly larger. But in practice, we don't. And in practice, historically, you know, politicians and economists have tended to believe that, in fact, although we know in theory some people could be made worse off, in practice that hasn't been such a big deal. And historically, it hasn't. And the evidence, for example, that NAFTA was harmful to U.S. workers is very, very limited. However, China was a very special case. It was an unusual, and some would say kind of a world historical event, how quickly China rose to a very impressive competitive position and how large it is. And that really did have distributional consequences. And I think a mature political process can recognize those consequences and say, well, we ought to have policies, not anti-trade policies per se, but pro-worker policies.
Right.
Policies.
Well, can I just jump in here for a second, Professor Otter? Because, I mean, it's you yourself, as you mentioned before, you've got some analysis that shows that increased trade with China over the past 20 years has cost more than 2 million U.S. jobs. But now with things like TPP, I mean, isn't China kind of in the driver's seat for this bus with TPP? And how does that then take care of the problem that you were just talking about earlier. Like, how do you craft a deal where the pieces of the pie grow for everybody?
Okay, so first of all, so China is not a part of TPP. In fact, the TPP is actually being established as something of a bulwark against China, if anything.
My mistake. I'm sorry. Thank you for the correction.
No. It's an important point. That it's a deal between the U.S. and many Asian nations to establish sort of ground rules, reduce barriers, and protect intellectual property, and make contracting secure. And in some sense, part of the goal of TPP is to prevent China from establishing the default rules, which will be much less favorable and much less predictable in terms of rule of law and freedom of contracting. Something else to stress in this is that China's, rapid penetration of U.S. markets really wasn't a function of trade deals per se. It was a function of developments in China. China was 40 years behind the frontier as a result of, bad policy. And Deng Xiaoping decided to marketize large swaths of the economy in the late 1980s. And that is the change that caused China to burst onto the world scene, in some sense, take the place it naturally should have as a labor abundant country with a well-educated population and a lot of technology. So that wasn't really trade policy per se. It was mostly about development of a country, but a very, very unusual and rapid progress in a country that is extremely large.
Right. So, you've sort of termed it the China shock that American workers have felt. I mean, I wonder, is it possible, though, to craft an international trade agreement where it doesn't come as such the shock doesn't fall so heavily on American workers? Can the trade agreement then, for example, demand better working conditions in factories abroad or comparative environmental regulations, the kinds of things that would level the playing field overall while also facilitating the trade?
Yeah, so I don't think leveling the playing field really should be the purpose of trade agreements. In fact, the benefits of trade come from differences. If we all have the same costs and tastes and technology, we have no point in trading. We might as well do it ourselves. But the policies that make trade adjustment less painful are actually domestic policies that help workers adjust. There are things like, wage insurance and training and active labor market policies that, help people move across one sector and into another. And most advanced countries do far more of this than the United States. The U.S. is extremely laissez-faire and has a very pretty flimsy safety net in this area. And for a long time, the political economy of that flimsy safety net was the claim that, well, no one's hurt anyway, so why worry about it? I think it's now clear that, at least in the present era, those scars are pretty significant, and hopefully that'll catalyze discussion of policies that can help workers adjust. So it's not really a matter of preventing trade. It's a matter of allowing people to adapt successfully without bearing those very concentrated losses. If we're all going to be better off because of, cheaper goods and services, couldn't we take some of that surplus and help the individuals who are on the losing end of that proposition?
Right. I mean, I believe a lot of people would say the answer to that should be yes. But if we literally have just a couple seconds to go, Professor Otter, I had one last question.
Sure.
Back in 1992, Ross Perot was talking about that giant sucking sound of jobs going south across the border to Mexico with NAFTA. So it's not this isn't the first time that we've heard about trade policy in a presidential race. Yeah. But why do you think it's especially powerful now that so many people care about it this time around? What's different?
The big difference is the decade of the 2000s was an extremely weak one for the U.S. labor market. And after the presidential election with Ross Perot, by the way, Perot was not right about NAFTA, we had a huge boom, right? We had the roaring 90s. And so people weren't so concerned about whatever else might be going on because, in fact, wages were rising, employment was rising, the U.S. productivity was growing really rapidly. But that's not been true in the 2000s, well before the Great Recession. It was a lousy decade. So people feel like they've got a raw deal. They're looking around for possible culprits. In the case of trade, they have a point for some workers. It's not so much true for immigration. People have latched on to that.
Yeah.
And it can be steered productively, I hope, not against trade, but in favor of appropriate trade adjustment.
Well, David Otter is a professor of economics at MIT, where he studies trade and labor economics. Professor Otter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.